There is something not often said about the 1430s and the 1440s in England. This was an era where belief in law and order, the system of government of England itself, was being eroded. Not overnight, that's why I mentioned a time span covering two decades, but faith in it begins to erode and becomes weaker. Now, why it does so, we're going to discuss in the upcoming chapters, but it is crucial to understand this as we go forward. See, in the chapters to come, we're approaching that pivotal moment that is the War of the Roses and its impact upon London. And history is filled with many historians who will give you a nice simple explanation as to why the War of the Roses took place. But this is the story of London. And in London, we know everything is actually much more complicated. And thus, I'm marking your card, dear listener. From here on, for the next few chapters, just be aware, like dripping water, faith is being eroded. The bedrock of a stable society, faith in the rulers and the foundations of law upon which those rulers gain legitimacy, is slowly fraying. Things are going to change. And everything's going to get a little bit darker and colder and a tad more brutal. Hi there, my name is Saul and this is The Story of London, a podcast that tries to tell the history of the city as it slips through time, following a chronological path so we can see what Londoners were dealing with as the events of the city's history came up and mugged them. This week we leap into the 1430s. Henry VI was the newly crowned King of England, but he was just heading across the Channel to be made the newly crowned King of France. Joan of Arc was being a pain in the backside of the English, and back home the King's uncle, the Duke of Gloucester, was being effectively the man in charge of everything, for now. In the city of London, well, after years of economic depression and stagnation, the English victories had briefly lifted the prevailing economic conditions, and suddenly there was an influx of bullion and the freedom to trade across the Channel, and all of a sudden there was a nut surge in profits. The mercers had grown in power and stature, and alongside them the livery companies of the tailors and the grocers still exercised vast amounts of power. London was able to afford grand and lavish celebrations for the young king, and seemed content to overlook the rather scandalous behaviour of the Duke of Gloucester, what with him dumping his wife, Duchess Jacqueline, for her lady-in-waiting, Eleanor Cobham. And they were willing to do that mostly because he appeared to be focused on improving London's merchants' profitability. It's why they tended to side with him over his arguments with his uncle, the Cardinal Henry Beaufort, the Bishop of Winchester. But this economic recovery was incredibly fragile and depended upon England maintaining the upper hand in France. And England could only do that as long as they maintained their alliance with the Duke of Burgundy, whose faction, the Burgundians, were involved in this bitter blood feud with the Armagnac faction, who supported the opposing French claim to the throne. Everything was hanging on a knife's edge. And around it, we had embers of religious bushfire rebellions and heresies which seemed ready to erupt at a moment's notice. It's a tense city, and as we go into the 1430s, tensions do indeed rise. This, then, is where the story starts, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to the next chapter of this chronicle as we see it start to descend into darkness. As we see everything start to begin to unravel. Welcome then to the ice at Gravesend. As we often like to talk about it, I'm going to begin this chapter with descriptions of the foundations and conditions of London. Then, as now, London was a place of constant building, demolishing and renewal. Nothing ever stayed put, and during the mainstay of the 1430s, this was certainly true. We know in 1431, the bridge which connected Ludgate Hill with Fleet Street over the River Fleet was rebuilt. You may remember some chapters ago there had been complaints about the state of the roads and the streets around this region, and these complaints had said that the nominal landlords, the Order of the Knights of St. John, had been rather neglectful in their attention to this region. Well, it seems they were remaining parsimonious, as the rebuilding of the Fleet Bridge was undertaken at the expense of John Wells, the grocer who was this year Mayor of London. So, a new bridge on the Fleet. Supposedly, a few years later, another great building was started downriver. At the time, it was known as Bella Court, a marvellous property built beside the river down in Greenwich. What had been an old abbey passed into the possession of the Duke of Gloucester, Humphrey, and he decided to develop the old building and construct something magnificent beside it. Bella Court was to have many names over the years to come. It was to become Placentia. It was to become Greenwich Palace. But right now it was simply Bella Court, quote, a fair building in the town, unquote, and it was joined by a fortress-like tower constructed beside it. Now, the location of Bella Court was somewhat to the west of the present Royal Naval College. While this tower, which was occasionally called Greenwich Castle, was intended supposedly as a lookout for any, you know, French invasion along the Thames, it soon became an attractive feature. But the Duke of Gloucester was not done yet. This year he also annexed 200 acres of Blackheath to go with his new estate of his. In the centuries ahead, this was to become known as Greenwich Park. And thus Bella Court, this magnificent building of rose pink, became the Duke's most desired home, eclipsing his London property of Baynard's Castle version 3.0. And in time, Bella Court would hold the Duke's magnificent library, which he was to eventually leave to the Bodleian up in Oxford. But to Bella Court and the bridge over the Fleet now must be added a third great structure built in London during this decade. In 1434, we see a tower being completed on the west side of the chapel at Lambeth Palace, under the supervision of Archbishop Cicely. It's known nowadays as Lollard's Castle, in the belief that it housed followers of John Wycliffe at this time of the persecution of the heresy. But no evidence has ever been found that any Lollards were kept there. Indeed, this magnificent structure of Kentish ragstone was known as the Water Tower at the time of its construction, and it was to become a new landmark south of the river. But if we are describing the changes to the physical buildings of London, we also need to describe the physical environment of London in this era also. And the 1430s was an important decade, as the weather turned bad, really bad, monstrously bad. The majority of the winters in this decade, perhaps 7 or 8 of them, were stricken by several weeks of widespread severe weather. And notice I say weeks and not the days of severe weather we tend to get in the modern era. At least one study of the weather of this period claims that the 1430s saw London experience bad weather on a scale that would not be matched until the 1690s, the so-called Little Ice Age. And nothing in our modern era can match the sheer impact of a decade of long, bitterly cold winters, which seemed to be filled with blizzards and freezing temperatures. And we know that the worst of these appeared to be the winter of 1434 going into 1435. Here, London encountered arguably its most severe winter ever. And so extreme and so cold was it that the River Thames itself froze, according to reports, from below London Bridge all the way to Gravesend. That's over 26 miles of river, a staggering distance, and it suggests temperatures unequal to any time in the last 1,000 years. It is said that cargoes had to be offloaded at the mouth of the great river and dragged along the ice to the city, and that The Thames was frozen even this far down, so thickly that it could bear wagons upon them. The records say that London survived this icebound hellish landscape from the latter part of November in 1434, and that the icy cold lasted through December, through Christmas, into January and onwards, and it didn't lift until the Feast of St. Valentine's, February the 14th in 1435, the most dangerous and savage cold snap ever seen in London's tale. How many died, we can't imagine. And in fact, it was part of a wider European cold snap that changed everything in the Low Countries. So we're talking about the area of modern Belgium, the Netherlands, Luxembourg, and parts of northern France. The winters from 1431 to 32 to 36 to 37 were all extremely cold, and spring temperatures were very or extremely low in 32, 33, and 35. In Bohemia, Austria, and the Hungarian Kingdom, the winters of 32, 33, and 35 were also outstandingly cold. We have reports of frozen lakes and rivers right across Central Europe and the Netherlands, as well as in England, and also reports of recurrent frost periods in April and May. We see crop failures being reported right across the continent in 1432, 33, 34, 36, 37, and 38. During those harsh winters of 1434 to 35, and also later in 36 to 37, in the London region, we see specific references to a lack of herbs such as laurel, sage, and thyme, which had been destroyed by the frost. And as well as that, we see a reference to there being a lack of firewood and coal. During this era in London, we do see prices rise for differing grains, as well as for wine, sweet wine, meat and fish. Now, I will say other sources report that the price rises in London were quite moderate until 1435, and nothing significant before 1438. But while that's true, there was also a rise in inferior bread being supplied to the populations, and a rise in malnutrition. And that caused a rise in epidemic diseases in the cold and wet conditions. It's not possible to identify what type of disease exactly. It's often referred to as pestis, and many think it's plague. But we know there are links between weather conditions and respiratory diseases. So all of this is hitting. Terrible winters, crop failures, economic crisis. And London was to find itself simply unable to cope with the environmental factors. And there was even more going on, because the extreme climate conditions during the 1430s had a strong impact upon the health and fertility of England's vast sheep flocks. Several accounts from southern England manors reveal that the years 1432, 33 and 37, as well as 38, a massive spike in the mortality rate in flocks of sheep. I mean, on average, you could expect, if you have a flock of sheep around this time, you'd have between 4 and 5% dying in a year. But in those years, it rose to as high as 32%, if not more. And as well as losing so many sheep, the climate also seems to have affected the fertility rate of ewes. And so this decline in sheep health and fertility led to a massive decrease in the productive rates of sheep fleeces. In other words, the amount of wool being produced dropped. And we can see just how much and how bad it is. In 1426, England exported 13,359 sacks of wool. In 1438... this was down to 1,548. This is a background of icy calamity, around which all future events will be based upon. And it is worth keeping in mind that everything I'm going to talk about in the rest of this chapter has this terrible series of winters impacting upon it. London was cold. London was frozen to the bones in the long winter months. And suddenly what's about to hit it makes a lot more sense. Now, we do know that during the 1430s, there was another Lollard uprising. Well, it wasn't really an uprising. It was kind of an event. And this event took place in May 1431. And it was centered around a man called Jack Sharp. Now, Jack Sharp was a fake name used by a gentleman who may have been called either William Perkins or maybe William Mandeville. And he was a weaver and bailiff, supposedly, up in the town of Abingdon in Oxfordshire. His nom de guerre, Jack Sharp of Wigmoreland, began his movement by distributing bills referring to a petition he was going to present to Parliament. These bills, you know, propaganda texts, were distributed across Oxford, in Coventry, and above all in London. The bills referred to a petition which was going to ask for the confiscation of the wealth of the church, and that it be, you know, the properties and so forth should be handed back to the state. A rather standard Wycliffean kind of complaint. The clergy of London and beyond were, as you can imagine, rather infuriated by this attack upon their worldly goods, and did not hesitate to describe its leader as a heretic. But at this point, the Duke of Gloucester came down on this whole rebellion thing hard. No, really, really hard. Which begs the question, why so hard? I mean, I'm sure, as the principal deputy of the King of England right now, he's in charge of defending the church, so that's kind of his job. But the sheer ferocity he used makes us wonder if there was another reason, maybe. And actually, we think there is. And that reason was because of where Jack Sharp was being based in. See, the lands he came from were lands belonging to Edmund Mortimer, the Earl of March. And that was kind of a complicating thing. And why? Well, the current king was Henry VI, right? His father was Henry V, and his grandfather was Henry IV, and he had toppled the throne from his cousin Richard II. And Richard II's father was the Black Prince, and his father was the late great Edward III. And out of Edward III's descendants, the Mortimer family had a claim to the throne via marriage dating back to round about the reign of Richard II. And thus, while the Mortimers were not strong claimants to the throne of England, they were claimants. And as such, anything that looked like it could be supporting them was escalated up as a threat to the current royal dynasty. And while this does sound rather fantastical and nonsensical, please note, 19 years later, when another rebel's going to arise called Jack Cade, he's going to pose under the surname Mortimer as the name carried gravitas. So here's this event in 1341, based in Mortimer lands. And while we are fairly sure that actually all Jack Sharp ever did was release some pamphlets and then summon a gathering of Lollards in Abingdon to talk about it, the Duke of Gloucester decided to come down on it like a ton of rather malevolent bricks. He left Greenwich and rode to Abingdon to destroy this, quote, assembly of heretics, unquote. The assembly of heretics took one look at what was bearing down on them and ran for their lives. Jack Sharp, aka William Perkins, fled to Oxford, but he was discovered and was taken just before Whit Sunday in 1431, and on the Tuesday in Whit Week he was hanged, drawn and quartered, and his head placed on London Bridge. Now, all of this was happening while the young king was away in France, and his arrival there had been a big thing, travelling with 1,352 heavily armed men-at-arms and 5,593 deadly English longbowmen. In spite of all this strength, the actual process of getting the young King of England to Paris to become the young King of France was a rather long, bloody and drawn-out affair. He arrived in Calais soon after leaving London, but it took him 3 months for all his escort to assemble, and then they made their way as far as Rouen before they ended up spending an entire year there. As a bonus, however, it was during that time that Joan of Arc was captured by a man called John of Luxembourg in May 1430. The Cardinal Buford could claim personal credit here, as he'd personally brought John of Luxembourg over to fight for the English side. And as such, the capture of Joan of Arc was a direct result of his intervention. Because of this, this young teenage witch and sorceress of France, at least as the English saw her, was now tried by the church and eventually was burnt at the stake under the authority of the English council. With her death, the English hoped to renew the campaign to place Henry VI on the throne. Anyway, after some shenanigans, finally a great progress from Rouen to Paris was at last made by young King Henry the following November. I say progress, the correct term is chevauché, which basically means a series of armed pillaging raids. So the young king was travelling to Paris with a huge escort, and parts of it would branch off to burn, rape, loot, and then rejoin, capturing places along the way. When Henry VI finally arrived in Paris, the traditional coronation rites of the French were enacted, and the young boy was crowned King of France. But the French were rather unimpressed at the parsimony of the English authorities. The bread and circuses around this coronation were mean and paltry, just one single small tournament. Paris was itself unaccustomed to coronations, and they had tried to do more to honour this boy king than had ever done for any other king, it seemed. Yet all this brought them was little profit, especially to the traders and craftsmen who had the right to expect some profitability from having a coronation on their doorstep. As well as this, the young king left the rather impoverished city on St. Stephen's Day, and Paris was left to endure a bitter winter of inflated prices, a scarcity of fuel and provisions. And before he left, he hadn't even done the basic things kings were usually expected to do, you know, release prisoners, abolish evil taxes. This was not a good look for the Parisians or for the rest of the French. But Henry VI wanted to return home, and after calling in at Calais, he finally landed in on Dover on the 9th of February 1432, reaching Eltham about St. Valentine's Day, and made his solemn entry into London on the 21st of February. The return, supposedly in triumph, of the King of both England and France was the cause for great celebration in London. And Henry again found himself processing through festive streets, displaying incredible pageants to the now twice crowned king entering into his estate, or as London was privileged to call itself, his chamber. These preparations, this particular street celebration, was even more elaborate than anything his father Henry V had faced. The city fathers had ridden out to meet him at Blackheath, the mayor dressed in resplendent red velvet, the sheriffs and aldermen in furred scarlet cloaks, the livery companies, the crafts guilds, dressed in their white livery, each of them embroidered with their own devices. And they even got all the foreign merchants to turn up in their national costumes. After the mayor made a big loyal speech to him about how much they thought he was awesome, they conducted him into the city. When they got to the bridge, raised on a pillar between two antelopes bearing the arms of the kings of England and France, was the now traditional figure of a giant, a sturdy champion, there to confuse the king's enemies. He travelled along the bridge, and there he was met by three locals dressed as three magical empresses. One was Nature, one was Grace, and one was Fortune. And they presented the young king with gifts, strength and comeliness, knowledge and understanding, prosperity and riches. And while they were doing this, 14 attendant maidens were singing along in Latin behind them. When they got to Cornhill, they found the Londoners had constructed the Tabernacle of Wisdom, and seven elderly residents were dressed up to represent leaders of the seven sciences, One was dressed as Priscian for drama, another for Aristotle for logic, Cicero for rhetoric, Boethius for music, Pythagoras for arithmetic, Eleusis for geometry, and Albunisa for astronomy. They moved on, and when they reached the Tun in the middle of Cornhill, they were greeted with a child dressed as a king enthroned, with people dressed as Mercy, Truth, and Clemency standing there to govern over him. And they were attended by 2 actual judges and 8 sergeants at law at the great conduit at the junction between Poultry and Cheapside. 3 virgins dressed as Mercy, Grace, and Pity drew up wines of temperance, good governments, and consolation from a well surrounded by a bunch of fake fruit trees. And 2 old residents dressed as Enoch and Elias blessed the king. A cheap cross, a royal castle made of wood, was covered in a branching genealogical tree showing that this king was descended from St. Edward the Confessor and St. Louis of France. And finally, at Little Conduit at the west end of Cheapside, stood a representation of the Trinity, with a great multitude of young people dressed as angels, singing praise to him. And after this grand and amazing pageant, this riot of cosplay and symbolic costume, the king attended a solemn service of thanksgiving in St. Paul's, and then joined in a further procession, escorted by the mayor and the citizens down to Westminster Abbey, where the monks met him with the relics and the sceptre of St. Edward the Confessor. And as long as heavy as it was, the young king still had the strength to bear it on his shoulder into Westminster. And after singing a Te Deum, he was finally escorted to Westminster Palace, where on the Saturday after this, a deputation of the mayor of London and the sheriffs and the aldermen waited upon him with a present of a golden casket containing £1,000 worth of gold. Oof. This was a extraordinary pageant, especially if it was done in cold weather, and it was done to impress upon the young king how powerful and loyal the Londoners were. And they needed to do this, as the brief economic flourishing of the previous few years was, alas, also turning cold and dying. London was re-entering a new economic downturn, and this, coming as it did after decades of decline, just kicked the snot out of London's merchants and businesses. We see profound changes really begin to impact upon the city. Take, for example, the grocers, a company I've featured and mentioned many times during this podcast. They were still around, but the old commercial centre of their trade was kind of broken apart. We see the grocers now focused over in regions like Bucklesbury and the Stocks, rather than in their traditional Soper's Lane. Also, at this time we see gone the great exporters of wool who had owned wharfs on the riverside parishes of Tower, Dowgate, Vintry and the Queenhithe wards. We see London merchants doubly injured by the crisis both in the wool and cloth trades, which had actually started back in 1428. In that year, the Duke of Burgundy had agreed to demands of the Dutch and Brabantine drapery towns and banned imports of English cloth. On top of this, there was a decline in the output of English coins by 45% going into the 1430s. And that meant that the government, now desperate for cash to cover the ongoing war, was forced to lean on taxes on the wool trade in increasing amounts. The consequences were that only the biggest merchants with the most capital could afford to stay in the wool trade, and everybody else was being squeezed out. And besides this impact on the wool trade, which, as we said, is going to be hit by bad weather as well as taxes, there's an equally large impact on the cloth merchants, as well as suffering from a temporary ban on trade with the Dutch provinces. A new law briefly insisted that English merchants should sell their goods to foreigners only for actual cash, and no credit was to be given to foreigners. And the result of this was that sales in cloth to foreigners in London declined rapidly from 1430 onwards and continued to do so until 1433. And even though that ban on credit to foreigners was abandoned after only a year, as sure as day follows night, Once the level of exports out of London dropped, inevitably imports into London also dropped. The fall of the entire overseas trade during the early part of this decade saw many London merchants slip into acute financial difficulties. We see men like John Poley unable to repay a loan of £90, which he had obtained from William Sevenoke, and he ended up fleeing the city. His lands in Coventry and the contents of his shop in London were seized as forfeiture. Another man called Richard Wilshire was unable to pay £40 to a London draper, and he ended up imprisoned in Hereford for his debt. When Thomas Brown, a grocer and woolman, who had actually led the attempt to break into the Mediterranean market back in 1413, he drew up his will during this decade, and that showed that he had little money to leave his widow and his sons. Apart from settling a modest amount of property on them, he left instructions that the remainder of everything he owned was to be sold to pay his debts. Even so, his widow found herself unable to pay them all and had to surrender some silver cups instead. And we see the case of John Hu, who owed money to several of his fellow merchants and was forced to take sanctuary in the Church of St. Martin the Grand, where he spent the remainder of his life avoiding his creditors. Things went bad quickly. And as such, that arrival of the young king back in London and the sheer lavishness of his reception was an expensive moment for the struggling city. The Common Council had decided that it would be bloody politic to mark this occasion by giving the king that £1,000 present. They also insisted that everybody should clothe themselves in new livery in order to welcome him, the purpose being to show that London was impressive and he should remember their generosity and help them. The problem, by the way, raising that £1,000 and everybody getting that new livery, London was already taxed to the max, and the citizens had refused to pay a poll tax, and there was no alternative but, well, to get the Chamberlain of London to pay for everything and the city pay him back. He was to be repaid partly from the profits of the common beam, the grocer mayor John Wells, again, farming the city for as much cash as he could. And he was doing this because he knew that no matter how straitened were Londoners' means, it was vital for any hopes of economic recovery that Henry VI and his council should look with favour upon London and its needs. That splendid reception, that pageant of fervent loyalty, was done under Mayor Wells' political direction. And it did pay some dividends, at least for him. In 38, he's going to be chosen to be warden of Norwich when serious riots led the king to revoke that city's liberties. But for London, the city itself, these lavish celebrations produced no reward. The city was running short of cash and needed to increase its revenues. And we see a Lord Mayor then obliged to write to all those who claimed citizenship but lived outside the city, demanding that they share the burdens of taxation and contributed immediately towards the cost of repairing the city. The purchase of citizenship of London by outsiders, which you could do for a sum of money, had become so common by 1433 that it aroused the anxiety and anger of the native population. They accused these new redemptionists of trading with foreigners, of not living in the city, of refusing to share the burdens of running the city, and of gaining the freedom to practice one craft while actually practicing another. Under heavy pressure, the mayor and the aldermen had to agree that all those who claimed citizenship must either live in the city or forfeit their rights, obviously not including any lords, knights, esquires, or lawyers. And they also had to reiterate that only the wardens of the livery companies should sponsor admission of outsiders into the franchise. Yet, in spite of all these restrictions and the awful winters and outbreaks of diseases happening that decade, there were no lack of newcomers either to seek their fortunes in London. But by looking at the nature of these newcomers into the city's livery companies, especially the major speculative ones like the grocers and mercers, it does suggest that the new entrants this decade were obviously taking the places of those who had died or as businesses had failed. This turnover in citizenship indicates that although there was no difficulty in meeting the city's increased demand for manpower, The majority of these new citizens of London were young men of little experience and little capital. Meanwhile, the monopolistic practices of the wool staplers, the cartel of wool merchants who were controlling all wool going in and out of Calais and had been based in London, well, they went on to limit their membership and forced up the price of English wool on the continent, reducing the number of people purchasing wool in Calais. Remember, the wool staple was supposedly the only legal place that you could buy and sell wool. And the result was that there was a sudden incentive for non-members of the stapler cartel and any foreigner to either smuggle wool directly to the Low Countries or to buy licenses from the Crown to evade the wool staple. And the Crown, by the way, was eager to sell licenses to evade the wool staple because they needed to raise money. So not only was London and its influx of new merchants handicapped by an initial shortage of capital, but in 1436 their struggling enterprise suffered a new blow, because the Duke of Burgundy eventually turned his back on the alliance with the English crown and returned to his allegiance to the French. And he then forbade English trade with all his dominions, with the consequence that from 1436, scarcely any wool was exported to Calais. Some wool exporters were soon unable to pay their debts and had to leave London. And all of this hit London's import and export trade in wool and cloth even more. And then add to that the pressure the Italians were making, because they're the chief beneficiaries of this breach between England and Burgundy, and they increased their own exports of cloth and wool. I mean, if you want a situation of how bad it is, all the signs seem to show that the Londoners were being entirely squeezed out of the dye trade and having to use Italians to cater to their diminishing customers. In 1427, for example, we see 8 Londoners having to make purchases from Italian merchants in Southampton. And yet they're outnumbered by the provincial merchants. 13 alone came from Salisbury. 8 came from Bristol. The Italians were now dealing directly with merchants from Hull, Newcastle, Coventry. London was being cut out of the domestic market, and they hadn't helped their position by renewing back in 1428 their demand that the Genoese should pay scavenge on anything they imported into the city by road. Long-term listeners will remember scavenge was the name of a tax. The actual sums of money they were trying to raise from the Genoese were tiny, but the tax became a symbol for the Londoners and their determination to defeat their Italian competition. Didn't really seem to occur to them that this might mean the Italians would just ignore London and move goods from Southampton to the provincial towns, which crippled the London market even more. And on top of this, the Genoese realised they suddenly held all the cards. They were supplying the impoverished English government, desperate to raise money to fund their wars in France, with more cash than London or anybody else could. The Londoners found they could get no support from the royal government. In June 1434, the Crown issued an edict which gave the Genoese special protection for 7 years and forbade the mayor and the sheriffs to levy any kind of scavenge on them. The Londoners had no more success in persuading the Crown in 1432 to make the foreigners pay an extra duty of 6 pence in every pound for the defence of the realm. And simply put, if London or anybody seemed to be imposing any kind of tax upon the Genoese, they threatened to leave the country than pay any customs. And the royal government again gave way. The Crown had come to rely so heavily on the customs paid by foreign merchants that it could not consider losing them, even if it did destroy the long-term competitiveness of the English merchants. The grocers were left with no other means of defending their trade than petitioning the mayor and using their powers of search to confiscate whatever imports they could find that were defective. It wasn't much, but it was something. Yet this domination of the English markets by foreign competition also impacted upon London's financial markets. You see, the Italians wanted to sell their imports quickly and invest the proceeds in English cloth to export to Italy. They did not want to wait for payment, so they were in no mood to extend credit to any English merchants, so they'd make quick sales to anybody who had the coin on them. But then equally, they were notoriously slow payers of any credit advance to them. However, I will say that's not entirely their fault. This was largely because of a serious shortage of bullion was beginning to make itself across Europe, which meant that even powerful Venetian merchants could sell very little English cloth or tin in Venice for cash and had to accept bonds that lasted up to 2 years. Now, despite the belief of most Englishmen that the Italians were draining the country of bullion by their importation of luxurious items, in fact, the balance of trade was in England's favour. In the 1420s, England had a favourable balance of trade with the Italians of over £100,000, and during this decade, it was up to £150,000. However, it was in the Italians' interest to postpone for as long as possible the settlements of their debts to English suppliers of wool and cloth. And this was a continued cause of complaint by the English merchants in Parliament, and was behind the move in 1437 to forbid credit to foreigners. We have accounts written at the time which graphically describe how Venetians were buying Cotswold wool on credit, selling it in Venice, and then transferring the proceeds by letter of exchange to Flanders, and there they'd lend it to Englishmen for the purchase of goods on condition that it was paid back in England with interest charged at the rate of 2 shillings in the pound for each month it was borrowed. Meanwhile, while this is going on, the Italians might take 2 or 3 years to repay English creditors. Overall, this was beyond a perfect storm of economic problems. And of all the places in England impacted by this, London was clearly suffering the worst. The amount of wool shipped through London dwindled to almost nothing during the latter part of the 1430s, and exports of cloth also slumped. Now, the small rays of hope were seen. Londoners' cloth exports began to recover because the Dutch refused to accept the ban on English trade. And they then went on to rise pretty well. And in fact, nationally, the amount of cloth being exported during the 1430s increased until it actually became double that of the amount of wool being exported. Overall, then, in the cold, long winters, London was economically in massive decline, coping with food shortages, barely able to cope with the twists and turns of outrageous fortune around them. As you can imagine then, tempers were frayed in London, and in 1436, we see this manifested again in anger towards foreigners, and in particular, Flemings again. And we see Fleming residents of London, terrified there could be another, like, purge of them, seek royal protection that year, so serious was the harassments in the streets of London. This was a crippling development. Meanwhile, politically outside of the city, things were just carrying on. When Parliament met in 1432, Cardinal Beaufort returned to England and had a bit of a brief political fight with the Duke of Gloucester, on which he came off victorious, but he was soon recalled back to the continent to sit at the Council of Basel. In 1433, the Duke of Bedford himself came over from France and attended Parliament that July. After publicly thanking him for the great services he'd done England and France, the Commons presented a petition that he should abandon the war and remain in England for the good governments of the country. The Duke of Bedford, who could not fail to see the wisdom of this course, was quite willing to agree and to become a full-blown regent. And this could have actually happened because negotiations for peace with the French had actually started and ambassadors had come over to France to negotiate it. The Duke of Gloucester, unfortunately, did not share the views of the party in favour of peace. He does not seem to have been particularly antagonistic towards his brother, but since he liked to be the head of everything, he preferred to have his brother, the Duke of Bedford, out of England and fighting in France. Besides, it was felt to be unbecoming to national pride to make peace with the French and thus acknowledge defeat. It was quite easy for the Duke of Gloucester to work up feelings of a large section of Parliament about this, and his militant policy, unfortunately for England, was implemented. The proposals for peace were abandoned, Gloucester's proposition for the renewal of war was carried, Bedford returned to his hopeless task in France. He never was to see England again, because in the following year, seemingly worn out by his endless labours, the Duke of Bedford died in Rouen on the 15th of September 1435. With his death, England lost her most able administrator, and the only man who could have hoped to quiet all the factions that were soon to play havoc back at home. Gloucester and his advisers found themselves in power, and they were now left without any check, because Duke of Gloucester was now officially the heir presumptive of his nephew, the king. By 1435, we saw more proposals for peace, but Gloucester's influence was now unimpaired, and they were again rejected. And then, as we said, by the next year, the Burgundians aligned with the French, and honestly, the writing was on the wall for the English. But then, while this is going on, in 1437, down in Bermondsey, the king's mother died, and her final months had been moments of immense controversy for the London and the whole nation, because the Londoners at this time discovered that Queen Catherine had been keeping a secret. A few years previous, it was decided that this French princess should no longer have a day-to-day say in the raising of Henry VI, and the Earl of Warwick had been placed as his strict and dour tutor, and the Queen had been allowed to retire into private life. And quietly, supposedly without the knowledge of any in the royal court, she had decided to marry again. And her choice of husband was scandalous. The clerk of the Queen's wardrobe, a minor Welsh squire called Owen Tudor. And Princess Catherine and Owen Tudor lived quietly and discreetly, and as extraordinary as it seems, it appears that the mother of the king and this low-born Welshman were able to have three sons without any news of it reaching the royal court. The eldest of these three boys was called Edmund, who later became the Earl of Richmond, and whose main claim to fame that he's going to be the father of the future Henry VII. Then after Edmund was Jasper Tudor, who later became the Earl of Pembroke, and then Owen Tudor, who went on to become a monk. However, it was the news of the birth of the couple's fourth child, their daughter Margaret, in 1436, that the marriage of Queen Catherine and Owen Tudor was discovered by the royal court, and the Duke of Gloucester hit the frickin' roof. Poor Catherine, who was incredibly ill, took refuge in Bermondsey Abbey, but her children were taken from her and given to the sister, the Earl of Suffolk, to bring up. This blow probably hastened the princess's end, because she died in Bermondsey on the 3rd of January 1437. Her husband Owen Tudor was promptly imprisoned in Newgate Jail for daring to marry a royal princess, but he was afterwards released and allowed to retire to Wales. And the same year his mother died, the king's grandmother, Joan of Navarre, the Queen of Henry IV, also died. She'd lived in retirement in Hertfordshire, and she died in Essex and was buried at Canterbury. At this point, the king was almost 16 years old. And it's about now he was declared to be of age and no longer required the services of a tutor or a regent. But it's interesting to note that in between the details of the death of the two queens, there is also this footnote that says, quote, "Also this year, all the lions in the tower died in one night," unquote. That reference to lions is important because we know in 1437 there was some kind of brutal epidemic amidst the animals in the Royal Menagerie of the Tower of London. We have no idea what it was, but most of the exotic animals were reported to have died, including all the king's lions. But round about the same year, there was a more symbolic event that took place on the River Thames. Those freezing winters, the icing of the river we described earlier, had caused damage to the one structure upon the Thames, the mighty London Bridge. And therefore, it should come as no surprise that on the 14th of January, 1437, the great stone gate of London Bridge collapsed. Or, to be precise, the pier on which it stood fell, bringing down the arches on either side and some houses. Somehow, It appears that nobody died because of this. At least one historian I've read said that the masonry from this bridge collapse stayed in the river for the next 400 years, providing an obstacle for boats navigating the river from now on. There was also no record of what kind of temporary structure was put in place while the new stone arches were rebuilt. But presumably, as the bridge was so crucial to London, something must have been put up to take light traffic. But as always, the symbolism of London Bridge collapsing, well, it is pretty obvious, isn't it? London was in a poor state. And with the war in France turning dramatically against the English, the Duke of Gloucester being rather inept and proud in how he ran the country, the weather causing food shortages across the continent, the inability, it seemed, for anyone to be able to prevent the declining economy or the influence of the foreigners or even the Genoese from ignoring any law they wanted with impunity, and with disease stalking exotic animals and food shortages in the city, and the very symbol of London, the bridge itself, falling apart. In this frozen city, it should be no surprise that faith in the status quo began to slip. As London approached the closing years of the decade, we can see here the first fragments of what is to come. Okay, I'm going to leave it there. I hope you're well. I hope you've enjoyed the sunshine or the rain, depending on, you know, what time it is in London. And I will be back next week for another chapter of this glorious story of London. Thanks for listening. I hope you have a wonderful week. This is Saul saying bye.